Welcome to the Farm to Table Talk podcast, where we talk about our food system from what we eat to how it's grown. I'm your host, Roger Wasson. Well, when we talk about farm-to-table talk, there are many people that get involved in the conversation, and one organization that many have heard about is the Environmental Working Group. And it's an organization that has obviously something to do with the environment, but has a lot to do with food and agriculture as well, and is involved and makes comments on progress or lack of progress and issues and concerns. And today I've got the person first. Yeah, I'm going to talk. Today, I have the perfect person to be able to discuss this. It's Ken Cook. He's the president of the Environmental Working Group. Ken, welcome to Farm to Table Talk.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Well, you know, I've got a couple things I want to be sure I'm covering with you. First of all, why don't you explain what is the Environmental Working Group and why do you exist?
Well, we're a nonprofit research and advocacy organization. And we got our start 22 years ago, and we started by working on agriculture, specifically trying to reform agricultural policy so that it paid more attention in a positive way to the environment, to sustainability, and to organic food and farming. And we started it with the idea that we would be producing research that would be affecting, shaping, changing debates about important issues like pesticides and soil erosion, wildlife habitat on farms, and so forth.
Got an airplane going overhead, so people didn't know that we're sitting outside, actually poolside for a conversation.
Indeed, at the first Organic Produce Summit. So we started working on public policy issues federally at the national level. And from there, we also branched out and started doing more work to reach directly to consumers and try and give them some advice. And it went something like this. You're speaking to an audience, and there might be, you know, half a dozen pregnant women out there, and they raise their hand and they say, well, if I'm concerned about pesticides, I'm concerned about the chemicals in my makeup, if I'm worried about these other environmental health risks, what can I do besides wait for the government to do something, because that can take decades? So we started to develop a whole array of consumer tools, too. How to eat a little more safely with respect to avoiding pesticides, how to find personal care products, cosmetics, makeup, and so forth that had fewer dangerous, hazardous ingredients. And so over time, our advocacy has become not just focused on policy, but working with companies, holding companies accountable, working directly with consumers and helping them basically lead healthier lives in a healthier environment. So it's been quite a journey, and we find ourselves now spending as much time with the private sector and working with companies almost as we spend in the halls of Congress or in Sacramento.
Well, that's pretty interesting. So are they trying to figure out how they do a better job, or are they coming to you and say, okay, teach us how to produce more sustainably or to be more responsible? What do they come to you for?
You know, it varies. We have a website called Skin Deep that where we list the ingredients of about 70,000 personal care products, everything you'd find in your bathroom or the ladies would find in their purse or that men would shave with, whatever. Those companies often come to us because our ratings have become influential enough in that industry that they want to reformulate and do better in our rating system. So we'll work with them and look at the ingredients they're thinking about, tell them how those ratings might go. We actually launched just earlier this year a licensing program for the products that do very well in our scoring system because so many companies said to us, we'd love to be able to say that we are formally meeting your criteria. So now we have almost 30 companies and over 300 products that already have our our brand on them as a licensor, and it signifies a very high level of performance with respect to the ingredients in those personal care products. It can be makeup or shampoo or body wash or any number of things. So it's just evolved, and in a way, it tells the story of what happened in Washington, right? Back when I was coming up in the 70s and 80s and 90s as a lobbyist, you'd run into your fellow environmentalists in the halls of one of the Senate buildings or House building, and you might have four or five environmentalists in a little clutch there, mm-hmm. shooting the breeze, and we'd all be working on a different piece of legislation that was going to pass that year, mm-hmm. a major environmental law in a different area. Clean Water Act, Clean Air Act, Safe Drinking Water Act, Wilderness Act, Alaska Native Claims Act, on and on, right? Superfund. Well, we didn't pass a major environmental law for 20 years until this year when the Toxic Substances Control Act was reauthorized. And that's because things got paralyzed in Washington. And as we noticed that, we found ourselves more drawn to the opportunity to work with the private sector where things could get done in many cases faster and deeper to protect the environment and human health than we had reason to believe we could make happen through the regular way that it was always done in Washington as I was coming up. And one of the most interesting dynamics for me is you have an environmental movement that came up in my generation. We were built to say no. We were built to stop things. But now it's critically important to create and build things. New segments of the economy, the solar industry been growing up, organic agriculture, food and agriculture really was the first green industry, in my view, in this country. And so now we're spending a lot more time working with organic food companies, talking about how to communicate the value proposition of organic to consumers, working with them to share good news about what their breakthroughs are, talking to them about how we can solve some of the bottlenecks, some are policy related, to get more organic land, more organic farmers, more organic food, more organic products out there.
Let me stop you there for a second, though. Weren't you getting started even before organics were created?
We were. We were the lead and nonprofit group in 1990, before we were Environmental Working Group. We were operating as part of another organization called the Center for Resource Economics. And when the 1990 Farm Bill debate came around in the House, and the question was, would there be a study done or some voluntary program for organic certification on the House side, as against what Senator Leahy had done in the Senate, which was the mandatory national standard program. And so my organization was one of the lead organizations that made the vote happen on the House floor that beat the Agriculture Committee and put Leahy's bill through the equivalent on the House side, working with Peter DeFazio from Oregon. He was the lead guy. He was a sophomore at that point in Congress. He took on the full strength of the Agriculture Committee, and he won. So we go back way, way back on organic. I was writing as a freelance writer about organic in the mid-1980s.
So somewhere in there, in this whole transition, your organization also created something that got a lot of attention called the Dirty Dozen. And I remember being around a lot of organizations, a lot of industries that were very upset because their fruit or vegetable made your list. But could you explain how that came about and explain that whole phenomenon, because it became very popular?
And it still is. We issue it every year. We had been doing a great deal of work during the 1990s on pesticide policy reform. We were heavily involved in the development of the Food Quality Protection Act, and we had done a whole series of reports up until that time, and continued to do them after the act was signed into law by President Clinton. How this came about was, this was, remember, during a time in the mid-1990s, late 1990s, when organic food was pretty hard to find. My friend Phil Andergan still likes to call organic private school for food. Mm-hmm. Great if you can find it, great if you can afford it, but not everyone can. And we know this is an issue that we have to solve. We have to mainstream it more. But back then, we would get questions like, well, what do I do? I live in Buffalo. Mm-hmm. In the wintertime, I can't find organic food. There's no local food available. I have snowdrifts to deal with.
Right.
I get to the grocery store. What should I buy? So we looked at that same set of USDA data, the pesticide data program, PDP, and we decided, well, let's look and see if there are some conventionally grown fruits and vegetables that are lower in pesticides. We had noticed that over the years. And so the first thing we did was we came up with the Clean 15. This was
it preceded the Dirty Dozen?
That was the first idea.
We said,
let's come up with the ones that people who can't find or afford organic but are concerned about pesticides, and
right.
not everyone is. And, our view from the very beginning has been, look, forget pesticides. Eat fruits and vegetables.
Right.
But if you are concerned about pesticides, try and buy organic when you can. And if you can't, here's a group of fruits and vegetables that,
right.
you know, the timing of when they're sprayed, the kinds of pesticides that are used, all the things that we know in agriculture can vary in terms of reducing pesticide residue and dietary exposure. We came up with this list, and then we thought, okay, well, someone's going to say, what should I avoid? And that's how the Dirty Dozen came about. And when we released it, we had no idea that it was going to become this thing that was on refrigerators across the country or in shopping carts, or that people would have it in their purse or their wallet when they went into the produce department. No clue that would happen. But that has been the case. And today, on any given day, probably 5,000 people come to that one page.
On any given day.
And look at that guide. And we update it every year. And, we know we've caused some, consternation, some dissatisfaction in the produce industry. But we do try and make it very clear that, and I think everybody in the organic produce world that I've ever come in contact with feels the same way. You know, our message is, if you're concerned about pesticides, this is a tool, but get in that produce aisle and stock up, conventional or organic. The risk of not eating fresh fruits and vegetables is far higher than the risk of the pesticides in those fruits and vegetables.
Well, and do you also tell them, go ahead and scrub them? I mean,
oh, sure.
Wash residues,
yeah.
Some
residue washes off, although the pesticide data program, that's as consumed. So they wash it, and if fruit is normally peeled or however it's normally handled, they do all of that before they do the analysis, and you still see pesticide residues in a lot of the produce. So these can be avoided. You can avoid thousands of exposure events a year. And then you combine that with, avoiding personal care products that might have ingredients in them that are of concern, sometimes of regulatory concern, and cleaning products and so forth. So we've built up our consumer portfolio in that fashion, but it started with the Shopper's Guide to Pesticides and Produce.
That's exciting. Well, I wonder, do you have any examples of somebody that's graduated that used to be on the list and they went lower on the list, or that they were a big concern, but as an industry, there goes that jet again, came back. They've done a better job in their industry and improved their ranking?
I think just in general, compared to where we were, say, 20-plus years ago, this is the anniversary of the Food Quality Protection Act, I think in general, conventional produce has many, many fewer pesticides in it of concern than was the case before mm-hmm. that law came into effect. Mm-hmm. So there's some regulatory response there. We are aware of a couple of companies. I won't name them because it's really their story to tell. Who saw either our Shopper's Guide to Pesticides and Produce or one of our reports, and decided to go out to their farmers who were supplying them and make changes in the contracts so that they had dramatically fewer pesticides. In the final product, as a result of just changing the requirements for contract growing for processed foods that used fruits and vegetables that those were primary ingredients. I think we hear an awful lot from the organic industry that they have benefited a lot from the Shopper's Guide to Pesticides and Produce, that it has kept the issue of pesticides out there, and it's also empowered consumers to go into the produce department, and maybe they had concerns before, and we helped them find produce items that you know, mm-hmm. alleviated mm-hmm. those concerns. Maybe they only bought organic. This reaffirmed why they would want to do that. But we heard from the conference today that retailers who stock more organic produce sell more produce and sell more food generally, that they're the top, you know, the top ranked mm-hmm. stores. And so as organic has mainstreamed, I feel like more and more there's more and more in common between the conventional and the organic growers with how they grow their crops, for one thing. A lot of the organic techniques seem to be bleeding over. We heard that today from several of the panelists that we were privileged to hear. And I also think that it's America. And our national slogan is not E pluribus unum from, you know, it's the customer is always right.
Yeah.
And eventually, when the customer says, you know, I'm just not wild about eating pesticides, and I know you're telling me they're safe at whatever levels, but I keep having this story in my mind, heard over and over again, that federal agencies say that a pesticide is perfectly safe. Sometimes they say it year after year for decades. Mm. And then one day they say it's off the market because it was not safe for kids. So I think people are thinking, well, you know, there's a system out there that is protecting me to some degree, but maybe with this tool I can protect myself just that much better.
How do you end up explaining, you know, to some people feel like there's no pesticides used for organic, but there are pesticides.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
But there's the magnitude, isn't it, that of pesticides used is much higher in conventional than organic?
There are many more pesticides approved for conventional than organic, and they many more of them have regulatory requirements, so-called tolerances, listed for them by the Environmental Protection Agency than is the case for organic. Organic does have a list of some two dozen, I suppose, pesticides that are available for use. Only one of them has an EPA tolerance. So by and large, they're more benign, but they are used. And, you know, organic farmers need to deal with pests as well. They can't just wish them away. And I think there's a lot of information that came out at this conference that shows that this is a continuing problem for organic growers as it is for conventional growers. So we basically say, yes, both systems use pesticides. The number and the toxicity of the ones used in the conventional system is very different than in the organic system.
Yeah, I'm curious, where has this taken you where you've gone on in media, for example? I mean, because I've had the impression that Dr. Weil and Dr. Oz and all sorts of people have you found yourself on what network news, which used to have a lot of people listening to Yahoo, to everything else? I mean, every time you come out with this, do you find that you're pulled into media attention?
Yes, I mean, you know,
there's our plane again.
Yeah, it's for your listeners. It's not a drone.
No,
so just to be clear. We're in the media a lot for the work we do because we do a lot of investigations on toxic chemicals and health. We do work on agriculture. We just produced a great series of reports on hog farms in North Carolina that generated media across the state. So we're adept at doing that.
Good, right?
It didn't say it was a happy situation in North Carolina. Too many hog farms, too much waste right next to where people live, ruined too many communities. But you know, we do find with the Shopper's Guide that every year it gets coverage on CNN or Dr. Oz or even mainstream papers. But the main way it's been circulated for the past 5 to 8 years is social media. Our Facebook page, our email list, we had, 5,000 people on our email list in 2008. Now we have 2.5 million.
Wow.
These are people who want to want to learn mostly about what they can do personally to make a difference for their kids. You got a bad diagnosis. These are the turning points in your life, right? You got bad news from the doctor, or you got good news. You're expecting a child. Whatever end of that life process you find yourself on, you begin thinking differently about personal health. And the environmental dimension of it, as the science has evolved, we know is very important. So we've tried to stay abreast of that connection between environment and human health for years.
Have you also paid attention to farm subsidies? Was that another one of your controversies that you published the people that got the biggest checks from the government?
Yes, there's you could argue it wasn't the best icebreaker with the with the farm community to do a research project that got from USDA the names of every single farm subsidy recipient in the country and the amount they received and put it on the internet. Oftentimes, when it's not the Shopper's Guide to Pesticides and Produce, it could well be the farm subsidy database that draws a reaction from a farm audience. And in some cases, farmers who get subsidies and are also on the Dirty Dozen have extra reason to want to talk to me and share their views. No, we felt like transparency was our calling card across all of the issues we worked on. In the case of the farm subsidy database, interestingly enough, we came to the conclusion after seeing conservation programs, including programs that would support organic farming. We saw the budgets cut for them year after year after year, even if we had agreements with the agriculture community. Let's go with a voluntary approach with incentives, and then we won't have to go forward with regulation. And you, as it were, made that deal, had a handshake on that. But in the aftermath, no one from agriculture went to the appropriators and said, hey, this conservation money is really important. This is what's keeping us from having to regulate.
Right.
And we saw that happen a number of cycles and finally decided, well, look, maybe we should tell people where the money's really going. The programs that never got cut were the subsidy programs for Midwestern agriculture and Southern agriculture and now crop insurance. So we started doing the best we could to say, well, look, this is where the money's going. If you like your investment portfolio in agriculture going to a bunch of absentee owners, people who live in cities, very large farms buying up their neighbors, then you've got the portfolio as a taxpayer you should stay with. But if you don't like that, we should have payment limits. We should think about shifting some of that money to conservation programs. Mm-hmm. We fired up the debate that way.
Speaking of firing up the debate, rumor has it we're going to elect a new president. And it's I don't know this campaign will ever be over, but maybe it will. And you assume that they're going to be talking about agriculture policy, and so that there will be a new administration come to town. How will you be engaging to make recommendations as what agriculture policy should be in the United States?
Well, that's a great question. I mean, every time we've had a big change at the White House, in the executive branch, we've really tried to make the case and get engaged early on. I think everyone in agriculture tries to do that, wherever you happen to be on any particular issue. The other thing that I've done in recent years, as a side effort to my work at EWG, is I founded an organization along with Gary Hirschberg from Stonyfield and Tom Colicchio from Top Chef and Wayne Pacelli from the Humane Society and a number of others called Food Policy Action. And Food Policy Action is designed to keep track of how Congress votes and performs on food issues. Everything from food stamps to conservation, farm subsidies, food safety, the whole gamut, and score them. And we're similarly going to be acting as Food Policy Action, trying to represent the food community generally, the food and agriculture community at the nonprofit progressive end of it, as we like to think of it. We'll be representing those views to whoever comes to the White House. We're trying to make the food more of a, as it were, a kitchen table issue in this campaign, but it's such a crazy cycle. It's really been very difficult to break through. You almost have to start with an insult that someone notices to get some attention and tweet it, right? But we're not in that business right now, so we're hoping still that there will be an opportunity as the debate gets into the fall. We're hoping some of the questions that may come up in the presidential debates may be about food, may be about food safety and the integrity of the food supply and what we need to do to deal with diabetes and other food dietary related illnesses. These are all the things we feel feel like are really important issues, as opposed to some of the goofy stuff that, unfortunately, we're spending a lot of time on in this campaign.
Well, and soon after November, they're going to be talking about somebody to be the Secretary of Agriculture, and then there's going to be the Assistant Secretary positions and administrators, and I suppose you're going to be wading in on all of those issues, too.
Yeah, no, we've done that pretty consistently over the years, and that's right. I mean, I think everyone knows that the Department of Agriculture is critically important in terms of leadership and direction, and to get someone in there who understands the full range of views about the food system and the full range of perspectives on specific problems, whether it's the SNAP program or farm subsidies or food safety and inspection, the organic program, etc. I think it's really important. And you know, there has not been as much effort until fairly recently in the nonprofit community to pay a lot of attention to federal agriculture policy. We don't have a tremendous number of lobbyists working on that in Washington. We don't have a tremendous number of experts who are working on federal policy around the country from the nonprofit community. So getting people to work together and magnifying our voices is really important.
Well, just kind of wrapping up, a couple of quick questions. One is, to do all this work, how do you pay for it all?
Yeah.
I mean, where does the funding come from?
Well, about a third of our support comes directly from individuals who contribute to us, small donors, you know, $20, $30. About a third of it comes from foundations, and another third of it comes from major donors. Then we also get some support from companies. We've been fortunate to forge alliances with some organic food companies and personal care product companies and others, and we're very transparent about that. It's all on the site. We have a budget of about $13 million now, 75 people working on the staff. So it's a hustle to raise the money, but we do a lot of great work, and it's always a pleasure for me to be doing that hustle, to go out and tell people about it, because I feel like we're filling a niche that needed to be filled, and we've been doing it for 20-plus years. I'm very proud of it.
Well, then let me just ask you one more thing. I mean, this pleasurable hustle that you're talking about, I mean, what makes you most enthusiastic and optimistic about this next stage, about where we are right now, and as you look ahead, what is it that gives you the most encouragement?
You know, this may sound odd, coming from an environmentalist who dedicated his life to trying to, you know, improve public policy and make change happen through law and regulation. I would say that the thing I'm most excited about is the degree to which the private sector, in many realms, is exceeding, with respect to speed and depth of impact, what we could possibly do at this point with regulation. The regulatory system is kind of slowed down, almost to the point of being paralyzed. But you have organic food companies and personal care product companies and solar companies. We've installed more solar in the past 18 months than we installed in the past 30 years. We're really seeing some hopeful signs in the economy. Sometimes there's a government policy underneath that's helping that happen, as is the case with solar. But in the case of the food system, it's just enormously exciting to me to see all the young people getting into these companies, starting up companies, coming out with great new products, filling the grocery aisles with products that we couldn't have dreamed of. And I'll tell you why it's so important. When you make the case, as we often make it, that things are broken, most people who don't live their lives thinking about these problems, but when you make the point to them, say, well, okay, that I get it, that's a problem, what do we do about it? Well, now we can point, in the case, just say, of agriculture, we can point to this whole $43 billion organic sector and the impact it's had even beyond just the organic products, because it's affected and positively conventional agriculture. We can say, look, it's no longer pie in the sky to say that organic can really solve a big part of these problems. In fact, organic is bursting at the seams to solve them. So to me, seeing the private sector kick in and do this great work is for me the most exciting horizon, and the thing I'll be paying most attention to for the rest of my career.
Well, thank you. And now if other people want to get excited about this horizon, where would you suggest they look online or otherwise to be able to find more information about some of the things you've talked about?
Well, the best place to find out about Environmental Working Group is to go to our website, www.ewg.org, and all of our work is there. You can sort through it as your interests dictate. I would say if someone's really interested, get on our email list. We send out a lot of emails about work we're doing, developments in Congress, exciting new breakthroughs in the private sector, and so forth.
Well, Ken Cook, president of the Environmental Working Group, it's a pleasure to have you on Farm to Table Talk.
Roger, thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining the Farm to Table Talk podcast. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter and subscribe to listen regularly on SoundCloud or iTunes to Farm to Table Talk.